Welcome to Self Work. I'm Dr. Margaret. Today we're talking to Jody Wellman, the author of You Only Die Once. I promise it's going to be great. First, a message from our sponsors. This is Self Work, and I'm Dr. Margaret Rutherford. At Self Work, we discuss psychological and emotional issues and what you can do about them, whether that's learning self-acceptance, taking action, or seeking therapy or treatment. 8 years ago, I extended the walls of my practice to reach those of you who might already be knowledgeable about mental health treatment, but also to those of you who might say you'd never darken the door of a therapist. And yet, you are here. I'll answer your questions while I invite you to take a few minutes for your own self-work.
Most people, when asked, and I think it's just that we're not asking the question of ourselves because we don't sit long enough to stop and truly be introspective. Unless you're seeing a therapist or maybe a coach, we're not stopping and actually doing the work to say, of all these parts of my life, am I feeling like I am participating enough as I want to be?
Welcome to this week's edition of Self-Work. I don't know if I've ever been more intrigued by a title of a book. When Jody Wellman's publicity folks reached out to Self-Work and the name of the book was You Only Die Once, How to Make It to the End with No Regrets, I couldn't wait to read it and to talk with her. She makes a statement and then she asks a question. Statistically, we get about 4,000 Mondays in our lifetime and 4,000 heartbeats an hour. How many Mondays do you think you have left? And more importantly, what would you like to spend your remaining time doing? I've actually seen something on the internet, on Instagram, that's very similar to this. A guy talking about, you know, how many times do you see your parents? Twice a year. How much longer do you think they're going to live? Maybe 15 years. So you're going to see them 30 more times. It's the same idea. But Jody Wellman wants you to start savoring your life and to make sure that you're spending your time in a way that's very, very regal. And I thought that the Friday before the new year would be a great time to introduce you to Jody and her book. And now, Jody Wellman. I've been trying to find the adjective. No, it's not an adjective. It's a verb. I have been intrigued by your book. I have loved reading it. And it is meaningful to me for many reasons, because I'm 70, because I was the daughter of a funeral home director, because I had anorexia for years, because. So right. Introduce yourself, Jody Wellman, and tell us about how you wrote You Only Die Once.
There you have it. Oh, Dr. Margaret, I'm excited to be here with you. I'm a fan of what you're up to. So, we tend to have a little bit in common already, I can tell.
Yeah, we do.
And the impetus for me around wanting to study and then write You Only Die Once was kind of maybe threefold. You know, one was that I've just always been fascinated by the bizarre idea that we are all perishable and we're just doing our best out there and try to love life. And then all of a sudden that could put one day it'll be gone. That always struck me even as a child as absurd. So that was an underlying theme. Mm-hmm. And then one of the biggest things I think was that my mom, when she was 58, died suddenly of a heart attack. And for many people, they would think that that's where the story is, that, oh gosh, it's always a grief story. And for me, it's not even really that. It is, of course, I miss her and love you, Mom. But I was more struck by the experience of cleaning up after her when she died and noticing this plethora of all of her dreams. I call it like the land of dormant intentions.
Yes.
Her apartment. All the manuscripts and the ideas and all these business plans that she didn't execute. And it struck me as this idea that not only is life short, but that, wow, you know, let's take action. She just kept deferring her ideas. I'll get to them later. And she didn't have confidence, but it was always this idea about, I'll get to do it.
Yeah.
And okay, I recognize that in myself, that idea that tomorrow is not a promise. It's a premise. So let's take action now. That was one of the main kind of kicks in the butt for me to get this topic going and study it. So I did a master's in positive psychology around it too.
And the other thing you mentioned is that, and you use the word squandered in your TEDx, that you that you felt like you squandered or wasted so many years with anorexia and bulimia, and that it was what helped you kind of get out of that? What helped you begin to say, this is what I'm doing to myself? And was it your mother's death that actually triggered that?
You know, that wasn't the impetus there. It's a really good question, because I do think a lot about it, knowing a lot of other people that are struggling with their own issues, you know, any kind of addiction, any kind of coping mechanism. And the way I look at it now is that it was this culmination of a few things. You know, it was the 10 years, as you noted. So that felt like a really long time. And when you're in it, it doesn't. It's when you look back and you go, wow, that was at that time, a quarter of my life, at the way the math worked. And so I had something meaningful to look forward to. That was a really big key for me. So I had enrolled and been accepted in this MAP program, so the Master of Applied Positive Psychology, University of Pennsylvania. And I was starting in September, and I said to myself, I think now's the time, honey. You know, like, I did not want to be going and studying positive psychology, studying the science of well-being, and, you know, having this this dirty secret that I was like sneaking off to the bathroom in between breaks. Like, that just wasn't really going to be the best life for me. So I think for me, I had that meaningful direction of I'm studying something that feels so resonant with what I want my life to be about. That was a biggie. And I don't know how you would describe it in the, you know, because you know, understand this professionally in a way I never will. But sometimes is there almost like it's just time, like the, like, I'm not trying to say that the sun and the moon and the stars aligned. I don't mean it that way necessarily, but that I had tried in different iterations, but this time it was the time that when I went to therapy, it stuck. Like, it just, it was the right moment.
Yes. I've had several of those in my own life. And in fact, it's funny. I didn't think about this as I was reading your book, but I also, in graduate school, I was a professional singer in my 20s and made this huge shift, obviously. And I was in an abusive relationship. And I'm marriage, and I realized that those two things I couldn't pull that off. I mean, I didn't want to pull it off. Again, the book is called You Only Die Once, which of course got my attention immediately. Great title. And, you know, you use a lot of whimsy and humor in it. There are these drawings that are very, I mean, they're lovely, and they're funny, and they're amusing, and they're entertaining. And yet the book is so powerful in this message of, you've got to find your own agency, and you've got to create every day your future. The next moment. You're creating the next moment right now.
Oh, I love the way you've summarized that. I need to write those words down. I'm going to get the transcript when this podcast comes out so I can use that. Thank you for noticing two things, because you're right about the tone. I started to learn pretty early on. So I was working, after I left my corporate career, I was doing leadership development and executive coaching. And I really wanted to be talking about this carpe diem topic. So when I started 4,000 Mondays, admittedly, I had a lot of fear about how I was going to talk about it and not totally turn people off so that they would leave the room. I mean, like, let's be honest, nobody wants to talk about death. It is a little bit unappetizing. Okay. Like, I'm hoping that your listeners are still listening to this episode with you knowing what the topic is, right? But I feel like the way to do it, to normalize and just almost poke fun at the ridiculousness and the irreverence of, hey, we're all in this together. And isn't it ridiculous that again, we're gonna be like, we're finite. And if I can doodle the Grim Reaper, which I do love to do, and if I can poke fun at it and have us chuckle at our lot in life and then death, then I do think that's the opening to get us to feel a little more comfortable with this taboo topic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So you use the term 4,000 Monday. So I want to make sure that my listeners understand why you're saying that and what that's all about.
Right? Is this a secret call?
By the way, I have 684.
I just love you for calculating, and I love that. By the way, did that give you feelings to do the math?
Let's just say I skipped it, and I went because I went, oh, I don't want to put a number on this. And then I thought, Margaret, if you're going to experience this book, experience it. And so I went back and made myself do it.
I love that you did that. And I also love your honesty that you tried to avoid it.
Oh, yeah.
It makes you so beautifully human, right? Like, I'll just keep reading. I don't need to quantify this situation, which we all know we could get way more, but unfortunately, not as many too. So, yeah,
4,000 Mondays, right?
Yeah. Yeah. That is the name that I gave my firm when I decided to make this my calling/living. And so 4,000 is roughly the amount of weeks that we get in life on average. So that is, and Mondays, because Mondays are always this indicator. Like, do you want to wake up on a Monday and like what you're doing, whether you're working or volunteering or just living, retired, whatever you're doing? It's a nice little, you know, put your finger on the pulse of your life. Or yeah, are you looking forward to what you've got in that week? Are you dreading it? Are you just kind of meh in the middle?
You asked another question that it really stopped me in my tracks.
Okay.
You said, how likely are you to recommend your life? Exactly. Yeah. Is that right?
Yeah.
Your life. How often would you say, I want you to live my life? You know, my life has been, and I stopped and I thought, and my immediate answer was no. And then I thought, now, wait a minute. How do I really feel about that? And it was a very thought-provoking question.
Oh, yeah, we're obviously playing in the sandbox of some discomfort, but again, we're going to make it fun. But there's a lot of thought provocation about, okay, wait a minute, if I wouldn't recommend my life, and many of us ostensibly wouldn't, like you came around, or you thought of it differently. That, I think, is really the spirit of like that kind of question, that kind of annoying question of, would you recommend your life? It's that I'm not here to litigate what went wrong. I mean, I could nitpick the 10 freaking years I squandered to eating disorders, and I could pick a bunch of other unsavory moments in my life I wouldn't want to replay or have anyone else live. That's not what we're here for. Like, yeah, no, life's too short to get dour. Let's stop and go, okay, noted that those were moments, and I understand why I did what I did to cope, or I understand that those were crappy years, or I was a victim, or this or that. But what do I want it to be like starting today? Like this afternoon, you know, or tonight or tomorrow, like that all we ever have is right now and moving forward. And so that's the impetus, is to say, can we learn a little bit from what we did, but most likely, or most importantly, under the recognition that our time is ticking, how do we want it to be? And how do we want to feel most alive in ways that are even often small? Because I think we overestimate what it's going to take to feel alive. And that scares me too sometimes.
But what kind of message do you want to give people about the book that says, if you get anything out of this, get this?
Oh, that's a really good question. I don't have kids, but I imagine right now it is a little bit like asking to pick your favorite kid, but I can play along. I can do this. Okay. My favorite, the essence of the chapter. So, you know, it's funny. My first instinct is not the right one. And I'll just share it with you, inside scoop into this wild and crazy brain, which is, my first thought was glom onto this idea of that temporal scarcity, which is count your Mondays. Recognize that we are limited time only situations, and therefore everything we do is precious. This is every moment's to treasure, because we are on this, again, I'm picturing right now like the egg timer turned upside down with hopefully a lot more time than what it takes to boil an egg.
Yeah.
So on one hand, that was one thought, but I think that the main thing is the idea that it is up to us to sculpt, to create. And I think that many of us, in honesty, have not given it a lot of thought, or we have ideas about what it might take to either make us happy or this sort of life that we long to live. You used the word courage earlier, but I thought was really interesting, because you needed to have the courage to maybe leave a relationship and to live the life that your grad school version of you was going to be stepping into. I think, you know, whether we have an idea, whether we fathom this life that would be great for us or not, you know, I think that on one hand, it's really valuable to sharpen and get really clear on what that looks like, because we're going through the motions and letting the days sort of appear. The sun will rise again. It's going to come tomorrow. And do we have a thoughtful, intentional way of approaching that day that might bring us more joy rather than it just being an indiscernible Wednesday that is really no different than Tuesday? So I think it's this idea about, let's get clear on what we would love to do, small, medium, big things. And again, with that overarching theme that why wait? Don't defer it. Mm-hmm. But like, let's live now. Let's stick up for the life we're living now.
You also, your whimsy and your humor comes in, but I thought some of the examples were incredible. You talk about how some cultures really worship death or celebrate death, like the Dia de los Muertos, the Aztecs did. And then we used to have parlors where we would lay the corpse of the person, they'd be there a couple of weeks hanging out, and everybody come and say bye. And then you said that all of that went away, and all of a sudden, undertakers took the body away as quickly as they could. And then we turned that parlor into living room. It was the living room. I loved it. I had never thought about that. It's the living room. Yeah. And we say passed away instead of died. I hate that phrase. Mm-hmm. So what I this is on page 99 for anybody who wants to know.
Another
incredible question was, what does your death mean to you? What does death mean to you? And you give 10, I think. You give 31, which I won't read them all. But it's things like death means pain and suffering. Death means personal extinction. Death means the end of one's dreams. Death helps give meaning to life. Mm. It's just this list of what do we tell ourselves about death?
Right. There's like a death acceptance scale, and there's this meanings of death and understanding. Mm-hmm. Getting in touch with our own attitudes can be really helpful, and not just, interesting, self-awareness, good to go. That's good too. But mostly because death anxiety, as I'm sure that you've experienced with so many of the patients you've worked with over the years, it, according to existential psychologists, at least, it sneaks in ways that sometimes we're not even super duper conscious of. It's this almighty sort of fear of whether, for some people, it's that death might represent oblivion, total annihilation. Mm-hmm. For some people, death represents the portal to an afterlife, which is a beautiful thing and hopeful. For some people, like, there's a understanding your attitude and what it means and what feelings you have around it can help you to either be more at ease with and accept that death is coming, almost from a Buddhist traditional way, mm-hmm. of just that it's neutral, like equanimity. We understand that it is on the horizon, and we look at a bouquet of flowers and we understand, oh, look, that begonia is dying just like me. And so just woven into the daily life, mm-hmm. versus, oh no, my beautiful bouquet of flowers is dying. That's terrible. Understanding our attitude can help us, because I love the research backing it up to show that when we are at neutral acceptance to death, not that we're positively anticipating it, not that we're negatively anticipating it, but that we just get it, that can alleviate so much anxiety, and it can help us to truly live rather than denying the idea. So if we deny the idea that, meaning if we don't contemplate it, if we don't listen to this episode of the podcast to the end, if we're not willing to talk about our fears and ideas and our bucket lists and stuff to our friends, and just to make it part of the normal part of our lives, it, back to this idea of it exacts the price of a healthy inner life. It's that I want to thrive. Mm-hmm. I want to feel good about life. And so the willingness to go there pays off in the end for enhanced well-being.
So let's take a break, and we'll be back in just a moment. Did you know that perimenopause can begin as early as 35 or 40? If you're a woman, you may have experienced subtle hormonal changes much earlier than we used to believe menopause began, and you don't know what to do or where to get really good information. Perimenopause, or the years prior to the time when your body begins to slow down and eventually stop menstruating, It's a natural process, as is menopause itself. But that doesn't mean they don't have their own unique difficulties. Certainly, perimenopause threw me for some emotional loops, and some of those loops can be heavily intertwined with mental and emotional struggles. The good news is you don't have to suffer through it anymore, because now we have Hormone Harmony, a formula made only with herbal ingredients that are shown to reduce hormonal symptoms in women of all ages. It's become a phenomenon. Women cannot stop talking about it. A bottle of Hormone Harmony is sold every 24 seconds. That's 50 orders in the time it takes you to listen to Self Work. Now, for a limited time, you could get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code SELFWORK at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code SELFWORK for 15% off today. I don't think that I'd ever resonated so much when someone talked about death as I saw Norman Lear quoted before his death, saying, it's not the going that bothers me or that hurts me or wounds me. It is the leaving. It's the leaving. Isn't that beautiful? And I thought, that's it. You know, because I was the daughter of a funeral director, I was always hearing about people dying. I worked at the funeral home. I got used to seeing corpses and, you know, hearing people say, she's just never looked better. And I'm like, oh God, what a terrible thing to say.
Sorry, Aunt Mindy.
Oh, gosh. I mean, you know, it was really kind of funny back then. I mean, people would call and go, who have you got down there? And I'm like, what? This small southern town. And so, you know, it was just a part of my awareness. But it, I also... So I guess I'm a little different than some people, or maybe all the other daughters and sons of funeral directors can understand this. But it seems like you're right that people don't want to talk about it. They don't want to realize that their temporariness, as you call it. When you sit down and say, what does death mean to me personally? I think it can really open some awareness of, what are you so scared of? What are you welcoming? I mean, I've had people of great faith who come into my office and say, I am struggling because I'm supposed to have all this faith that my death is going to be the, as you said, the portal to the afterlife, but I'm still scared.
Yeah. I love, you know, and the normalness of that, you know, this very idea, it's sort of like how you and even your TED talk about kind of normalizing when people sometimes have suicidal ideology in a way of wanting to feel like, hey, is this an outlet for me? It is one of the most normal things is to experience anxiety or fear around this notion that we're going to come to an end. And I think back to the exploration, some of us, you hinted at it. It's the idea of, like, back to your Norman Lear quote, it's the leaving. That leads me down the path of what motivates some people to do this thing called symbolic immortality, which is that we don't like the idea of leaving, meaning that we might miss people, but we also might feel like, wait a minute, like my 83 years was all I got out of this life. I want to put a stamp on the world in some way. You know, it's why like every kid puts their initials in like concrete as it's drying. You know, it's this desire to be like, I was here. And so symbolic immortality is like a mechanism that we use, which is whether it's conscious or unconscious, doesn't matter. It's like even having kids is one of them. Like I will create something that will endure beyond me. Maybe it's even like writing a book, or it's like having all these fabulous podcast episodes in perpetuity. It could be donating so that my name's on a brick in the local library that I donated a little piece of chunk of change that bought 78 books. I don't know. Something that we could creating art, like the creative arts is a really fascinating way that for many people feel, not only are they compelled to express themselves creatively, but for some people it's designed to endure beyond them, that maybe if I give it to my grandchild, that they'll give it to their child who will give it to their child. And, you know, it's this little desire in us, like the, back to maybe Viktor Frankl and like man's search for meaning, or this idea about, right, classic, right? This idea of like, we have a will to live and we have a desire to create enduring value. I always like that expression. enduring value. Enduring endures often beyond our mortal years. So sometimes that provides a wee bit of comfort for us that, oh, okay, good. At least this park bench will be here with my name emblazoned on it. And when I'm gone, at least someone's going to be sitting on it feeding the ducks.
You know, that makes me think of the story about when is the best time to plant a tree. And they say 30 years ago. When is the next best time? Today. And the author of that, or what I read about it, is that they wanted to say, you know, there are people that are planting trees today that know they will never sit under their shade. And so, but they're doing it because they, maybe it is symbolic immortality. It's about giving to the world, giving back to the world. And I've always loved that, always loved it. And you say something else, that humility tames your fear of death. I really paused and thought about that a good deal, because I think that's right on target. Because it is the great equalizer. It's the great equalizer. I mean, we all die. And so it's, and that humility about I am really no different than anybody else as far as my humanness, and that you can embrace that and then more accept that what you know will end, and what, and then you're, I also heard something, Jane, the gorilla, Jane.
Goodall.
She's being interviewed, and they said, what are you most, she's, I think, 90 or 92 or something. And they said, what are you most excited about? She said, I can't wait to die. It's going to be such an adventure.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I need to find that.
Yeah, I loved that. And I thought, you know what? What an interesting attitude to have about time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, right now, this is so interesting, this conversation, because you're making me think about how, like everything, you know, some like chocolate, some like vanilla, we have different attitudes towards death. We have different attitudes towards, you know, the way to live our lives. And I would never dare to prescribe, you know, I use the words living an astonishingly alive life, but that's all relative to however you design your days. They don't need to be flashy. They could be simple, sweet. They could be glitzy, whatever you want. But this idea about if death is like, for some of your listeners right now, if you're the Jane Goodall category and you're like, oh my gosh, it's going to be an adventure, because maybe there's a belief that you have that it is going to be doors opening, whether it's pearly gates or not, but to something that is fantastical and different. Cool. And that's something that you can maybe look forward to. For some people who feel like, when I am out, and I will have no other cares in the world, I don't care about anything, then sometimes that drives them in different ways to make sure that they're living life fully now. Sometimes that definite abrupt ending can create a little bit more of a sense of urgency towards living now. And so this takes us back to this Irv Yalom, or existential psychologist, talks about often it's the fear of the unlived life that causes anxiety. And so this notion, if you feel like when you're dead, that's it, that's all, and you're not going to get another chance, of course, at this life, then you might feel that sense of despair that is quite frankly a bit of anguish about the life that you are postponing now, or the life that you are not choosing to participate in as much as maybe deep down you'd like to be. And that can be a really interesting revelation for some people. That's sort of the way I see it, is I feel like there are times where I'm not participating as much as I want to be. That makes me feel proud that I'm doing life, you know, because I'm a homebody and I'm an introvert. So it's always going to be easy for me to just snuggle under the couch, you know? And so then, but I'm recognizing that what motivates, and for some people, if it is that I'm really motivated, I'm afraid that when I die, I'm gone and no one's going to remember me, but that might motivate them to do things, live in such a way that they are mentoring the youth of today, that they are making sure they're spending time with their grandkids, giving them nuggets and wisdom and jokes and anecdotes that they'll always remember grandma by or whatnot. So I think that understanding what we think about at the end can help us sculpt the life we're living right now in meaningful ways.
And there's also a meme going around on Instagram or something, I don't know, but it's saying, you know, everything you own today will be owned by someone else or won't exist. Your great-great-grandchildren probably won't know who you are. The legacy of your life may or may not be, but for many of us, will fade. Yeah. And so I think when you realize, and then so that what they're leading you to is to say, so how are you going to live this next moment, this next hour? How are your values aligning with the way that you're living this moment? I was asking myself the question as you were talking. I wonder if the self-work listener would want to know, how do you know you're living your life in the most real, full way you can? Does a bell go off? Ding, 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 ding. You know? Does.
Right, there's a litmus test. You put it up against your forehead and it's the right color. You're living right.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a little nebulous for many people.
It's a really good point. You know, even that question of to what extent, this is a heavy one, ready? To what extent do I feel like I'm like living up to my potential? That one's enough to send us into a spiral. But many of us we have an inner knowing. And I also think that, I have that 68 question, astonishingly alive questionnaire that I put in the book. It's also on my website. And it's this way of diagnosing the dead zones. It's a way of looking at your life and going, wow, look at all these domains of my life. There's my social life, my physical life, my work life, my recreation life, and all the areas of life and going, oh, this feels kind of cool. This feels good. And ooh, but for some reason, like there is I flatlined, you know, over here. You know, maybe on my recreation and leisure life. And that might be an area I want. So I think diagnosing it can be helpful when you even doing simple things like filling out a simple assessment. But most people, when asked, and I think it's just that we're not asking the question of ourselves because we don't sit long enough to stop and truly be introspective unless you're seeing a therapist or maybe a coach. We're not stopping and actually doing the work to say, of all these parts of my life, am I feeling like I am participating enough as I want to be? Mm-hmm. And how much do I want to be? So I kind of know like my prescription for what makes me feel alive, and I'm able to better stop and say, okay, am I showing up in ways that make me feel excited? And I know that for me, that means doing things that are like planning maybe a surprise date night with the husband where we're going to go to some crazy new show or play or something that we might laugh at later or something, creating a little surprise or going to, lately again, I took him to a monster truck rally knowing that it would just be so out of our usual zone. And I've always been so curious. And like we went and it was such a fun thing. So those are examples to me of, have I peppered my life with enough of those things that I want? Or for some people it might be, I know I just want maybe one spontaneous thing a month, or it's that I want to go and do some, I want to travel and experience something that is new and novel, you know, at least every 2 weeks. I'm not suggesting everybody has to have a fanatical schedule, because for some people that might be the equivalent of a boring life is to schedule it.
Exactly.
But the idea though is if we put our finger on the pulse and actually ask the question, we're going to get an answer about whether or not we're feeling like we're living wide enough with vitality and deep enough with meaning. I think we have an inner knowing. What do you experience with your patients and clients and so on?
Well, I think probably the first thing that comes to mind is a lot of them are experiencing some kind of depression or anxiety. So that can really affect their thinking and their feeling about whether or not, you know, how, in fact, if anything, sometimes their life feels very deep, but it doesn't feel very safe. So I think that they've got to figure out how they're both being some sort of subsumed or swallowed up by their illness, and how do they begin to step out of that and see their illness as separate from them. So a lot of times people come to me and or any therapist, and they're just demoralized about the meaning and or the vitality of their life. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, a lot of therapeutic work is about getting people connected to that. Mm-hmm. To say, you know, is it trauma that has led to your depression or anxiety? Is it, you know, what has led us there? Let's give it a context, but then let's start moving to create more of that life that you want, and that you deserve, and that you can. It's, you know, this is, you don't want to have such an overwhelming sense of sadness or melancholy or anger or fear that mm-hmm. you live in that state of being all the time. Mm-hmm. And so I think my work and any therapeutic work is about, or most therapeutic work is about working through whatever is then has led them to lose that sense of meaning or vitality and helping them yeah. move forward. Yeah. And have specific goals. How will you know that's happening? How will you know that's happening? Mm-hmm. That, you know, how will you know that I've done myself out of a job, which is my job.
Right.
So, you know, my work is very meaningful. I mean, every time I drive home, I'm, almost every day, I have a sense of that kind of understanding that we can get so lost. So what is the, when you speak to an organization, I mean, maybe obviously it's going to differ, but what is people's response to this message? I mean, you've gotten a lot of views on your TEDx, so, and I read a lot of the comments and they were very interesting, but what, and then my second question would be, how has delving into this topic changed you? How are you different?
Great questions. Yeah. Well, I never cease to be surprised. And, you know, one day I'll smarten up and not be surprised by this, but by the number of people that might come up to me after any kind of talk or workshop and say, I think like that too. And it almost feels like this is secret society. Back to the idea about mm-hmm. no one wants to talk about death. So I do think that Stoicism has gained popularity and the topic of memento mori has gained some traction. And so it's not like, you know, we're admitting to liking something illicit and illegal. But I do think that there are a lot of us out there that are of the belief of the seize the day kind of ethos. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think that what I'm always encouraged by in the workshops I do is that, you know, I'll frame everything in the spirit of like, you know, time is ticking, but we don't linger there long. It's usually about, and so now what do you want to do? You know, what would be things that you could do to widen your life and deepen your life? And what regrets might you have that we can course correct today? Yay. That creates an energy that I think people are yearning to talk, even in professional settings, whether it's an association or a corporation or whatnot, women's group, whatever. Like, we just want to share with each other the stuff that brings us joy and lights us up mm-hmm. and it's contagious. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that is something that builds, and that is, that's always just fascinating to see. And then to your question about what has changed me as a result of this. Mm-hmm. I do sometimes wonder, just between us and I guess, you know, your listeners, if I am studying this and talking about this and really encouraging us to go there, because maybe I have some deep, dark, deep-seated denial of my own that I'm just trying to sort of surreptitiously crack. We can hold that one for another deep dive psychotherapy episode. But I actually think like I really love the topic. I'm really passionate about it. I think what it has, this has exposed me to is, dare I say, my own need for this. I call myself like I'm an absolute honest hypocrite, where I talk about living wide and deep. And I talk about that not because I've got it nailed and why, oh my gosh, you should see how wide my life is and how deep it is. And I'm doing this astonishingly alive.
Yeah, exactly.
It's because I need to be reminded to live almost daily. Mm-hmm. You know, I need to be reminded again, like I'm in a city right now. I'm in Boise. And I'm in my hotel room and I will work and I'm looking out my window after we're done and I could go out and explore. And that would be the version of the life that I would love to live today.
I do and have some advice for you. The last time I was in Boise, I ate escargot. Yeah. Do not get escargot in Boise.
Thanks for the hot tip. I will not make that part of my widening experience in Boise. Thank you. But so I need to be reminded. And so I actually, you know, I like it that I'm not going to pretend ever that I am living in a way that everyone should. I mean, my gosh, do as I say, not as I do. But I also like the fact that I'm the example of how we just need consistent, constant reminders that, oh, yeah, you know, we get busy and we get swept up and we delude ourselves into thinking, oh, I'll do that cool thing later, or oh, I'll start that project later. And we need to be reminded. We need the constant countdown. That's why, you know, me knowing this week, 1,809 Mondays left. I need that. And I need it because I'm not alone. We all need that. We all need, no one here listening, it's news that we're going to die, or everyone's heard the idea, life's short, live it up. Like, we all know this.
Yeah.
But we need reminders, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, Jody, thank you so very much. It's been a great pleasure talking with you. I definitely think I'm going to recommend highly the book, You Only Die Once. And what is the subtitle? Hold on here. How to Make It to the End with No Regrets. So I thank you for being in here, especially since you're in Boise. Thank you for making the time.
Oh, this is time well spent being with you here. Thanks, Dr. Margaret.
Sure. I loved that conversation. I'm so pleased that she was on Self-Work. I want to wish you all a safe and happy new year. 2024 has had its moments of inspiration and anguish, certainly. And I'll welcome you back next week in 2025 to Self-Work. Thank you for being here. As always, take care of yourself, your loved ones, and your community. I'm Dr. Margaret, and this has been Self-Work.